Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss the personal politics of health. Lately, I've been alarmed by the proliferation of wireless technology in the form of new products that combine cell phones with cameras and messaging, computers that connect to the internet without plugging in anywhere, Blackberries and Palm Pilots that are small wireless computers, and many are marketed to children. Additionally, cities are contracting with providers to blanket municipalities with Wi-Fi radiation and to install cell phone towers and antennas on top of every building. I'm concerned because as a journalist, I dig around, and what I've discovered over several years is that the science is adequate. It shows a broad range of very serious health effects, ranging from skin cancer, leukemia, chronic flu-like symptoms, persistent inflammation of mast cells in the skin and all over the body, gut, brain changes, even seizures. So why isn't it out in the news? Well, because parts of the industry seem to be censoring its release. Very eminent researchers here and abroad are being harassed, their labs shut down and their funding stopped. There are even laws on the books that favor telecommunication companies in disputes with citizens who want to protect their neighborhoods and their children. So I'm concerned, and I want you to be also. Without consumer feedback, the industry will never seek safer ways to deliver its useful and by now necessary technology. I have three guests today. We'll start out with medical journalist Blake Levitt, and in the second half we'll hear from Jan Newton, president of the EMR Policy Institute, and independent filmmaker Doug Loringer, whose film Bad Reception chronicles the struggles of the citizens of San Francisco. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. The San Francisco Chronicle Sunday edition featured an article on nuclear power as the green energy alternative. The article focused on how to economically meet the dramatic increase in electricity demand that's projected over the next 30 years. While reading about the virtues of nuclear technology, I searched in vain for any mention of nuclear's health risks or how we are to dispose of spent fuel rods that remain deadly for tens of thousands of years. If the problem is that we have to supply 50% more electricity over the next 30 years cheaply and at the same time keep a lid on greenhouse gases, then looking to nuclear might make some sense. But if the problem is how we safely meet our energy needs, then nuclear goes out the window pretty fast. This is how the precautionary principle is supposed to work. Solving a problem isn't about evaluating a limited number of technologies. It's about actively understanding what we're trying to accomplish and then finding what will do that, whether it's a technology or not. I'm a member of Media Alliance, a terrific Bay Area organization that advocates for open access to information. But Media Alliance has become mesmerized by a technology. It actively promotes the installation of citywide wireless technology in San Francisco and celebrates other cities doing the same. The reason for Media Alliance's enthusiasm is their commitment to closing the digital divide, the dramatic inequality in access to the internet and its resources. As you know, on this program, we regularly discuss the potential health risks associated with wireless technologies and exposures to radio frequency radiation. On several occasions, I've communicated those concerns to Media Alliance. The first time was last fall at a conference. I had an opportunity to discuss with Media Alliance representatives. I've offered myself and Lena as resources. I was reassured that grassroots organizations had recently made Media Alliance aware of wireless health risks and that they would incorporate that information into their advocacy. 2 months later, I checked the Media Alliance website. I was surprised to find none of the promised information on wireless health risks and that the organization continued to promote the public health benefits of wireless. The only health information came from the FCC, accompanied by ill-informed assurances that, for example, since hospitals have wireless, it must be safe. I sent email with no effect. Never mind that simply installing citywide wireless doesn't include the computers the poor will need to actually access the Internet, or the training they'll need to use it effectively. Never mind that Media Alliance, however noble its intentions, does itself no credit by limiting access to information that would enable people to make an informed decision about wireless. The digital divide is a symptom of inequity. Empowerment overcomes inequity by enabling us to take care of ourselves, for which we need access to credible information. From what I know, one of the best ways to do that is through human contact. More difficult and more expensive than plugging in a box, it's also much more to the point. For a copy of this editorial, you can go to the website yourownhealthandfitness.org and go to the radio show page. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is a political economist and health educator. He co-produces this radio show and manages the operations of the nonprofit, Your Own Health and Fitness. You can reach him by going to our website where you'll find information on membership benefits, or you can call him at 707-874-1496. And now to our topic, which is wireless public health crisis. And the guest that will occupy this first half, who is B. Blake Levitt, L-E-V-I-T-T. She's an award-winning journalist who has specialized in medical and science writing for nearly two decades. She's researched the biological effects of non-ionizing radiation since the 1970s. A former New York Times writer, she's written widely on medical issues for both the lay and professional audience. Her works appeared in numerous national publications. She's the editor, contributing author of Cell Towers, Wireless Convenience or Environmental Hazard, Proceedings of the Cell Towers Forum, State of the Science, State of the Law, Safe Goods, New Century Publishing, in 2001. She's also the author of Electromagnetic Fields, A Consumer's Guide to the Issues and How to Protect Ourselves, and it's from Harcourt Brace, and it was published in 1995, and she won an award of excellence from the American Medical Writers Association. Ms. Levitt's work is referenced in numerous government publications and other resources on EMF. She's helped several congressional offices write legislation for energy research appropriations and land use issues pertaining to antenna and tower siting. At the invitation of U.S. Senators Patrick Leahy and James Jeffords, she participated in a congressional briefing on the environmental effects of ambient energy exposures in 2000. In May 2002, she was an invited speaker at the Royal College of Physicians in London on the environmental effects of non-ionizing radiation. She lectures widely on the subject of environmental energy and consults for municipalities considering telecommunications regulations. Welcome to you, Blake.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Lena, and I just want to say that you're to be commended for keeping an eye on this subject. You've done several programs on this, and not a lot of people are doing that, so congratulations to you and thank you.
Well, and not a lot of people were researching this issue in 1970 when you first started doing it. So, you know, consumers really love these products.
Oh,
why?
They really do.
Right. Why should they be concerned? What's the problem?
Well, the problem is that no safe level of non-ionizing radiation has ever really been determined, despite what the telecommunications industry would like to have you think. No safe level of RF in particular has ever been determined. And every time somebody goes to take a look at whether it's the power line frequencies in the extremely low frequency band or all the way up through the visible light band, they're quite surprised by many of the findings that they come up with.
Well, in fact, I recently had Ole Johansson on the show, and he is the sort of premier researcher at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm. And, of course, what we know is that even people who don't feel the effects of either electromagnetic fields or radio frequency radiation still have their mast cells in their skin reacting. And he's seeing enormous increases in the rate of cancer since the introduction. So there's no lack of science showing this. Most of it is now being done outside of the U.S. because of the industry.
That's true. There is an enormous amount of science. And most people don't realize it because it's The science that we're talking about is called bioelectromagnetics and biophysics, and it exists kind of off to the side, all on its own. Most clinicians, the medical clinicians, don't really understand the wealth of information that exists in this area. And it's too bad, because there's a serious disconnect between the sciences. Unfortunately, bioelectromagnetics, from the start, was pretty much the purview of the physicists and the engineers, whose focus is really on I call it the non-living sciences. They're physicists and engineers deal with the physical world devoid of living systems, whereas biology deals with it's the study of living systems. Unfortunately, what's happened is that the entire area of bioelectromagnetics from whence the technologies come, the studies that are conducted, the standards that are set, they're all in the hands of the group that's actually creating the technology. And that's been traditionally true from the 1940s with the advent of radar on U.S. ships during World War II.
Now, you had mentioned, well, just to go back for a moment, the bio effects, the biological effects of, you know, we were distinguishing between ionizing and non-ionizing radiation, but in fact we see DNA breaks from both. Do we not?
Yes, we do indeed.
Okay.
Many of the distinctions that are made, especially having to do with the non-ionizing bands, are primarily distinctions that are made for the clarity of the systems and for the engineering details. They're really not biologically based. They're not biologically understood. That's a complaint that comes from all sectors of bioelectromagnetic science. When for instance, august bodies are trying to talk to the FCC, they are, for instance, saying things like the standard for RF exposure that's in place at the FCC is not biologically based. It's dosimetry based. It's for the convenience of the technology and for the convenience of the people who need to talk about it in particular ways. But the science that is there is longstanding. Most people don't understand that this is a very mature science. It's not a newcomer to the field. The reason that it's getting so much attention now is because we've now had this deep market penetration into the lives of so many people globally, but particularly in Western cultures, with cell phone technology. Just 10 years ago, that wasn't the case. And so now you have a much more exposed population to frequencies that have never existed before, at exposure intensities that have never existed before, and we're only just now beginning to pull together the data that is finding adverse effects. It doesn't really surprise anybody that knows anything about this subject that 10 years out we would be finding brain tumors and seizure disorders and any number of other things. It doesn't surprise anybody that's been watching for a while.
Yes, although it continues not to be reported on in the conventional press. And one of the reasons for that, what I was going to say is that you mentioned to me that the research databases are contaminated.
The research databases are often contaminated, but I think that there's another reason for that, Lena. Mm-hmm. One is that it's very difficult to penetrate this. And when you're, and I say this as a reporter, a science reporter, when you go into a story, no matter what the story is, you have to be able to locate the center of the story. If you can't locate the center of the story, you don't know what the extremes are that are being talked about, so you don't know what's reasonable to present to your audience. Science journalists come at this from the soft side. They're mostly interested in biology. They cover medicine. They cover environmental issues. They don't typically cover hardcore physics stories, which is what bioelectromagnetics is. On the other hand, you've got the technology writers who very much embrace the physics and the engineering side, but they know nothing about the biology side. So to some extent, you've got disconnects in the profession of reporting in and of itself. And if that's not complicated enough, the reporters that do take the story on very often feel compelled to present what are called both sides of the story, so that you will get a reporter stacking quotes for the, for instance, an individual study's authors will say one thing, the public relations department will say another, and then the telecommunications industry, for instance, will have something else to say. It takes up a tremendous amount of column space, and at the end of most stories, it creates a certain amount of paralysis. It makes the reader think that, well, they're just going to wait until all of this mess gets cleaned up before they make a decision, when in reality, it is a form of contaminating the database.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many other ways to contaminate the database as well.
Easy for you to say. Easy for you to say. Well, you had also mentioned something about test parameters being influenced, and you mentioned something about Motorola and some confidentiality clauses that backfired on them.
One of the problems with this area is that the bioelectromagnetics research community started, as I said, back in the 1940s and 50s. This is the research group that actually taught the others how to create confusion at the national dialogue level in order to create paralysis. Once you have paralysis, you don't have any movement in public health policy. That's very much the dynamic that happens in this research community. One of the ways that the database is contaminated intentionally is, for instance, when a health study comes out that has found adverse effects at extremely low intensity exposures, what would be considered non-thermal exposure levels. For the radio frequencies, for instance. If a study like that comes along, one way to contaminate the database is to either not replicate the study, just never come up with the funds to replicate the study if you're industry. And then later on, when the standard setting committees put together their list of work that they're going to examine to figure out what kind of a standard needs to be in place, they will typically set a parameter that will say we will only look at replicated peer-reviewed studies. So if something hasn't been replicated, it ends up in the interesting anomalies basket, but it just does not get factored in as a serious work. That's one way to do it. Another way to contaminate the database, I mean, that's just sidelining studies, so they just hang out there and nobody takes them into consideration. Another way to contaminate the database is to replicate a study, but to change the test parameters in a way that almost guarantees that you're going to get a negative effect. And then what you can say later on down the line, if you're the industry, for instance, is, well, that test was replicated and was found negative, when in fact it wasn't really replicated. Something was changed in there that was of critical importance. So there's a bunch of different ways to sort of, you know, jimmy around with the science, and unfortunately they have become very adept at doing all of that.
And particularly Motorola, was there something you wanted to comment there?
Motorola used to have a very good, even just five to ten years ago, a pretty ethical research lab, as did Bell Labs with AT&T. I mean, these are the labs that actually brought us the technology. And one of the things that they got very good at doing, as did the Cellular Telecommunications Industry Association, which is now the Cellular Internet Association, I believe, is they started signing scientists to confidentiality clauses. If you are a scientist in one of the private research labs, say like Henry Lai at the University of Washington, you have to raise a certain amount of money in order to keep your lab going. And what the industry figured out very easily is that if they didn't fund the labs would close. In fact, four out of the five major research bioelectromagnetics labs in the U.S. have closed in the last 7 years. They've completely shut down. So that research has completely disappeared from America. I think that the University of Washington's lab is the only one that's still standing. It's also the oldest lab in the country for this kind of work. But one of the things that they do is they sign, before they will give the research appropriations, they'll sign the researchers to confidentiality clauses, which means that the researcher cannot talk about their findings or anything having to do with the study until it's been published, and they also they're also required to give the funding agency final edit, so that the company, if it doesn't like the fundings, the study may never find the light of day. And if a researcher talks about it, they can be hit with major lawsuits, and that's become quite common, these confidentiality clauses. Motorola, by the way, a couple of years ago tried to pull that same technique with European researchers, and they just kind of laughed them right out of the European arena.
Yeah, though
they didn't get very far over there.
There's some bad stuff happening in Europe, too, right now. I just want to ID the show. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm on the phone with B. Blake Levitt, L-E-V-I-T-T, award-winning journalist. Her two books on this issue are Cell Tower Wireless Convenience or Environmental Hazard, which is the Proceedings of the Cell Tower Forums. And then there is also Electromagnetic Fields, A Consumer's Guide to the Issues and How to Protect Ourselves, which is published by Harcourt. one of the ways that I think people think that this must not be happening is they assume that if this is really dangerous and bad, that the progressive community, you know, the environmental community, are going to be fighting this. And what we're seeing is that progressive organizations and environmental agencies are basically, to use your words, checked out on the topic.
You know, it's very perplexing. I've found that it's difficult to get the environmental organizations to really understand this, and I think that's because it's a difficult area to understand, and you need to have a passing understanding of physics in order to understand the kinds of things that are being said in the studies. For instance, there's a tremendous database that is available electronically that lists abstracts of these studies. But you know, to the average person that doesn't have a background in physics, you won't even know what these measurements are. You won't understand odds ratios. You won't understand any number of things. And so it just looks like Greek to them. They don't know how to interpret that. And unfortunately, they don't seem to go one step further. Also, there has been a lot of misinformation, particularly with the power line frequencies, for instance. People think that they know what they need to know about that, and what they think they know is that that's been found to be of no significance, and the book has been closed on that. Well, nothing could be farther from the truth. As a matter of fact, since that major perspective was floated through the National Academy of Sciences back in 1996, and research came to a halt on the extremely low frequency area, it's become pretty commonly accepted now in most bioelectromagnetic circles that the extremely low frequencies are a known cause for childhood leukemia.
Very much so.
Not a whole lot of causal agents are known for childhood leukemia. The fact that that is just presumed now to be one of them, but most people don't understand that. I got a call, for instance, from a woman in Maine who had bought an electric car. Now, electric cars have been, you know, completely embraced as green automobiles by the environmental community, which is great if there's a technology that could be made safe. But the early electric cars, for instance, had readings because the batteries were, you know, in the back seat, and the main conduit to the engine went right up in between the drivers and the passenger seat. People were getting readings of, you know, 40 to 50 milligauss in the back seat near the battery.
That's high.
That's the equivalent.
You're supposed to get maybe what? If
three,
you're two?
Three at the most.
Yeah.
Three milligauss at the most. That 40 milligauss exposure with a child seat next to it is the equivalent of an occupational exposure.
So before you go any further, I have to know whether the hybrids are also a problem.
I was just about to say that it would appear that many of the manufacturers have taken some of this to heart, even without being told that they must. I'm not sure what Toyota's readings are these days, but people have said that they're considerably lower. And I was in a Ford hybrid over the holidays, and I took my Gauss meter with me, and effectively got no readings in the front seat or the back seat at all.
Oh, that's good news.
It's very good news. So, but the thing is that consumers need to bring awareness to these products.
Exactly.
And if you take electromagnetic fields out of the biological paradigm as something that cannot be understood, does not need to be understood, then you're in trouble. But if you bring awareness to the individual products around you, there are ways to live more safely within this technical world.
Well, the other thing that's important to know is that we are layering layers upon layers upon layers of new ionizing and non-ionizing radiation.
So All the time.
Yeah, so we are essentially, since the advent of FM radio, as I sit here and talk on FM radio, that was the first wave. Then we had television, and from there it's just been increasing. And there's a limit to how much the human body has evolved to tolerate, the nervous system to tolerate these levels. I mean, you get lots of phone calls from people because you're in the highlight. What kinds of things are you hearing from people?
Oh, I'm hearing all sorts of things. People with cell towers that go online, their health is literally crashing, and this is something that's being observed all around the world. Mm-hmm. The Irish Environmental Medical Association, a doctor's association, for instance, has put out a statement saying that they're seeing any number of adverse effects in their patients. There's something else called the Freiburger Appeal in Europe that that lists here. I'll just read you some of the things that that they list in their patients. These are environmental doctors throughout Europe. These are the things that they're observing most closely. Learning, concentration, and behavioral disorders, including attention deficit disorder, extreme fluctuations in blood pressure that are ever harder to influence with medications, heart rhythm disorders, heart attacks and strokes among an increasingly younger population, brain degenerative diseases, Alzheimer's and epilepsy, and cancerous afflictions, leukemia, brain tumors, prostate problems, lymphomas. And then there are a host of psychological things that occur, psychological or psychosomatic. They're misdiagnosed as those things, but they're in fact physiologically based. Headaches, migraines, chronic exhaustion, inner agitation, sleeplessness, and daytime sleepiness, interference with brainwave patterns, tinnitus, susceptibility to infection, nervous and connective tissue pains. And a host of other things that I don't like to just read from a list, that will give you a general idea of what's being reported out there.
Studies in Europe tested ambient radio frequency radiation and found that it's gone up 3,000% in the last 10 years.
Yes, they did a study of approximately 10 cities, and that's what they came up with over ambient exposures just 10 years ago. And it was telecommunications technology was thought to be the main culprit.
We have a problem. We have a Telecommunications Act that doesn't allow us to act.
Yeah, that we do.
Okay, so how
that was one of the biggest power grabs in favor of one industry, probably since the build out of the railroads in the 1800s.
Mm-hmm, I believe
I've never seen anything
quite frightening. So, but you say there is a way to sight a tower in a safer way.
Oh well, there are a bunch of things that you can do, planning and zoning issues that can be quite effective. But first I wanted to give some a little bit of scope to some of these things. Cell towers. 15,000 new cell towers have been erected every year for the last 4 years in America. There's almost 200,000 cell sites nationwide now. That's huge. At the moment, you were talking about Wi-Fi in the beginning. Wi-Fi is a very low-powered but high-frequency, extremely high-frequency. It's a 2.45 gigahertz system that creates just an absolute electrosmog over an entire area. 199 U.S. cities and towns had plans for Wi-Fi systems, and that was as of July 05. 99 municipalities already have some kind of a system. And the reasons that they give for that are for safety. I can't quite figure that one out. Business opportunities and for community building. As far as I'm concerned, no town should go Wi-Fi without a certain percentage of the licensing revenue set aside for their public health departments for long-term epidemiological studies that should track disease states 10 to 20 years out. Louisiana, for instance, after Hurricane Katrina, they're talking about not even bothering to build a wired telephone system.
Oh, dear.
They're going to go Wi-Fi. It's one big
dear.
Experiment down there. But the thing is that if nobody's looking, you can't find what you're not looking for.
So very quickly, before we're almost completely out of time, the relationship between, there's this issue of how strong is the frequency, because Wi-Fi is low, and everyone says, oh, it's very low exposure stuff. But it appears that those are worse than the...
Let me say one thing about that. In looking at the bioelectromagnetics literature, there is a dynamic that comes up in this area of science that I've never really seen in any other area. It's called a nonlinear effect. Nonlinear effects mean that you experience the most profound biological reactions at the lowest exposures, not the highest ones.
Right.
That term shows up in so many studies of low energy systems that it's more the norm than the variation. Now, what that means is that we are dealing with a completely different model when it comes to human exposures with the energy modalities than we are, for instance, with toxins models. Toxins models are, you know, standard things of how many parts per billion of trichloroethylene in drinking water before, you know, some sort of adverse effect comes up. We have a lot of savvy with dealing with toxins models, but if nonlinear effects prove to be the accurate way of dealing with low energy exposures, then we're dealing with a whole different magilla, and nobody really knows how to regulate that way. That's one of the problems. But the thing is that there's a very good possibility that the lower exposures may be more bioreactive because the human anatomy is a very finely tuned electromagnetic organism. Everything about us is electromagnetic. Brain waves, the heartbeat, cell division, potassium ion channels are getting a lot of research money these days. There are links to diabetes. Microcurrents are the way the cell talks to other aspects of the world, and electromagnetism is actually the language that the cells use to talk to each other about any number of biological.
That's a big mistake to mess with the stuff. I regrettedly have to let you go, and I really appreciate you taking this time to go over these issues. We've been talking with B. Blake Levitt. It's L-A-V-I-T-T. Her books are Cell Towers, Wireless Convenience or Environmental Hazard, and Electromagnetic Fields, A Consumer's Guide to Issues, How to Protect Yourself. Her website is blakelevitt.com, BLAKELEVITT.com. And I thank you so much for your time.
We only scratched the surface, Lena.
That's okay. We're going to keep going for the second half hour. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure.
So we're going to take a brief musical break, and we're going to get Jan Newton on the line and Doug Loringer, and we'll continue this discussion about Wi-Fi public health crisis. So this is Lena Berman, Your Own Health and Fitness. Please stay with us. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman. We are doing a show today about Wi-Fi public health crisis. If you missed parts of today's show, you can go to our website and listen to it all week at yourownhealthandfitness.org. The full hour show is always available there all week. You can also get a copy of this or any other in the series at the website, or you can call 707-874-2772. And now we're going to continue our discussion about Wi-Fi public health crisis by bringing on Jan Newton and Doug Loringer. I'm going to give Jan her introduction, and then I'm going to go directly to Doug Loringer for an update on what's happening in San Francisco. But to let you know who's with us, Jan Newton and her husband Dale were two of the founding members of the EMR Network, which was formed in November of 1998, partially in response to learning that the Telecommunications Act of 1996 forbids local and state governments from regulating the placement of antenna sites based on the environmental effects of radio frequency radiation. She was executive officer of that organization till June of 2003, when with Deborah Carney, she went on to found the EMR Policy Institute, their website, emrpolicy.org. Their mission is to advance sound public policy on the use of EMR and to educate and update the public through their website, again, emrpolicy.org. And Doug Loringer, independent filmmaker, in 2002, he co-founded SNAFU, S-N-A-F-U, the San Francisco Antenna Free Union, a grassroots citywide coalition of community residents and neighborhood groups that focuses on the impacts of proliferating wireless technologies. His independent film is Bad Reception, The Wireless Revolution in San Francisco. Doug, I'd like to start with you. I'd like you to quickly give us some kind of update about what's going on in San Francisco as as consumers try to fight the proliferation of cell towers and the Wi-Fi blanketing the city. So what's going on?
Well, just as some quick background, I mean, San Francisco has approximately in the area of 580 licensed cell phone sites currently active, which have over 2,400 individual antennas operating. That's to provide cell service for companies like Singular and Sprint and Verizon and so forth. We've got a large Sutro Tower complex, which with many radio, television, high-powered antennas providing all types of wireless service throughout the whole Bay Area. Then we have the unlicensed Wi-Fi, is what you've been talking about, where anyone who has the money can go to a store and set one of these up in their living room or in their office, and we have them in coffee shops and so forth. And currently we have the city of San Francisco itself heading towards operating its own citywide Wi-Fi network, and currently the city has put out a so-called request for proposal to different vendors to propose how they would set this up and run it for the city or in conjunction with the city. And those responses are due by the end of this month in February. So once those get formalized, our organization, along with others who are concerned about it, will be working to try to prevent the city from going the Wi-Fi route as we have fought against, for example, in cell phone antennas since the year 2000 as a citywide organization.
San Francisco is a pretty good example of what's happening across the U.S. I think it's, as a municipality, the interesting part is that San Francisco is a progressive city, so the citizens have been educating themselves, and they're organized. One of the problems here is that the FCC standards are inadequate. So the industry seems to be just out of control. You know, they're just sort of grabbing up these cell phone towers and stuff. So what kind of successes has activism in San Francisco had?
Well, it's interesting because the telecommunications industry has quite a powerful lock through its lobbyists on the elected officials in San Francisco. Unlike, say, hundreds or perhaps thousands of communities around the country, we were not able to get a temporary moratorium on cell towers while the city rewrote its zoning guidelines about where they could and couldn't place these things. But absent that, we have had success in the past 5 years. We've, by appealing individual antenna applications by the major corporate cell phone providers, we've stopped 12 of those before the Board of Supervisors. In addition to that, we've convinced a number of property owners around the city to break their contracts with the companies who want to place these on their property. And by the way, that remains really the only certain way anywhere in the U.S. to stop a licensed cell phone site from going in is to convince the property owner who signed a contract with a company to break that contract. And often that will be a church or a school, and often the companies will not file a lawsuit against this contract being broken because of their fear of the negative public relations type of response. So we've had successes that way, and by organizing and really by focusing on our elected officials, because no matter how much money gets contributed to their campaigns by telecom industries or how much the lobbyists have influence over them, they still have to be elected, and they have to therefore answer to the people who elect them. And so that's by bringing focused pressure on certain of these cases, we have had success that way. So that's one way that people anywhere really in the country can start to direct their attention is on their elected officials when individual cell phone licensed towers come up for consideration. Now, Wi-Fi is a somewhat different issue because it's unlicensed, and we may talk about that a little bit too.
Yeah, and it seems to go in without much public notice.
That's correct. At least given our antenna siting rules in San Francisco, there's a certain notification when a licensed carrier like Verizon or Singular or Sprint wants to install an antenna. People living within 500 feet of the site are supposed to receive a mailing notice of this. Wi-Fi, though, it's unlicensed, and because any individual, not only our government, can go out and set this up, there's absolutely no requirements that people even be aware of this. So you can have someone living in your apartment next door operating a Wi-Fi a wireless network in their apartment. This thing could be set up right, you know, across the wall from where your child's crib is. You may not even know this is happening. So Wi-Fi, and because Wi-Fi is not licensed by the FCC currently, ironically, it does give us the opportunity to raise the health issue before our government when it comes up, because the Telecommunications Act you mentioned before specifically prohibits a local government in the United States from considering health concerns for the placement of licensed antennas, the cell phone towers. Wi-Fi is, because it's in kind of a more nebulous legal category there, we will certainly be asking the city, raising the issue of the health before it decides to finally go ahead with this, which we hope it ultimately will not.
Brief ID of the show. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and this is the second half of the Wireless Public Health Crisis show. I've been talking to independent filmmaker Doug Loringer, and we will soon be going to Jen Newton from the EMR Policy Institute. So we'll be with them in just a moment. I'd like to get Jan on the line. Do we have a good connection with Jan?
Yes, we do now.
Okay, we've got a bit of a buzz on the line with you, but I think we can manage. You were going to give us some kind of a sense of what's also going on. We just heard Doug talking about what's going on in San Francisco in terms of where we stand. I'm wondering if you can bring us up to date on what's happening in New York City, in Manhattan, and in the East Coast.
Well, there's been an effort in New York City spearheaded by Councilman Peter Vallone, who's in the Astoria District in Queens. Came about primarily from the siting of antennas close to school grounds. And he heard of there have been numerous antenna sites close to public school properties in New York City. So that's one group of constituents that got the ear of Councilman Peter Vallone. And he's worked on a couple of measures incrementally, and one of them that was passed in 2005 was for any new sites, antenna sites in the city, to be cataloged. Up to that point, the city didn't have a record of where the antenna sites were, so that's going to be a major effort in New York City to try to get a handle on where the sites are. And nationally, our organization, the EMR Policy Institute, brought a case to the Supreme Court in 2005 asking the court to require the FCC to update its exposure guidelines. Unfortunately, the case was not chosen to be heard. So it's the second case that has gone forward to the Supreme Court.
So it was declined?
It was declined in an earlier case that went in 2001, and Doug was a part of that one as well. People in San Francisco had a brief along with ours on that one, and the court declined to hear that case as well. So it looks like no remedy is going to come from the courts, and that takes us back to trying to get something to happen in Congress. And an effort we're working on is legislation to have Congress put EPA back in the position of responsibility for environmental levels of radio frequency radiation. They, in the legislation that brought the EPA into existence, they're assigned that responsibility, but the FCC really has been carrying the ball on it and not doing an adequate job of it. So we're looking to get language in place that specifically empowers the EPA to be looking at this as an environmental public health issue, which the FCC doesn't have that emphasis. So they state clearly, and anytime you ask them this question on paper, what you get back from is that they are not a health agency and that's not their purview. So kind of right now there's a no man's land, and we're trying to get language through Congress to take care of that legislative void that exists presently.
Well, it's really frightening because the federal government's not helping us. They're not protecting us, and it's being dumped in the lap of the consumers. How do people make a case if something comes up? I mean, a lot of this, as we've just discussed with Doug, is the stuff starts, aside from the fact that you can be living in an apartment and somebody puts in Wi-Fi and somebody comes in and can probably, open a laptop in your apartment and use the internet without even plugging in. There's so much Wi-Fi, just ambiently through the walls. So how does a consumer who's concerned even begin to make a residential case?
There's, as Doug says, with Wi-Fi, there's really not much you can do because it's an unlicensed application of wireless technology. The only time you can really make a case is when it's a zoning issue, which means cell phone, base stations and that type of thing. So as Doug said, what you have to do is try to make a case to the person who owns the property where it's happening, that they have some liability for it. And really an uphill battle.
So essentially what it means is that the consumer has no rights, that the only one that has rights in this situation are these companies at this point. I mean, is that where we are? Either of you can answer that, Doug or Jan. That's how it appears to me, is that the companies with the Telecommunications Act are being protected, and unless, Jan, your organization can bring enough suits in front of enough of these courts to get noticed, the only other thing we can do is just hammer away at our politicians about this.
Hammering away at the politicians is the way it's going to have to go right now. There was also a bill passed in 1999. It's called the Wireless Telecommunications and Public Safety Act, which the good thing it did was make 911 the emergency number countrywide. Before that point, it wasn't necessarily the case that you could call 911 and get emergency dispatcher anywhere in the country. That's true since that bill was passed. That's the good part about it, but the questionable part about it was encouraging it, as the bill states, a ubiquitous, seamless, wireless infrastructure nationwide, which would then guarantee that you could get 911 anywhere on a cell phone. Part of that, part of the legislation grants an immunity from liability to wireless carriers, the way the language is worded, in including dispensing any kind of personal information because of a 911 call that may have been made, but it doesn't tell you what is excluded from immunity from liability. So that remains to be seen. Again, that's going to work its way through the courts. If someone has a liability issue because they're living close to a base station, and a few years down the line, they can establish they had adverse health effects from being that close to antennas, or if it devalued their property when they went to sell a home, or anything like that. It remains to be seen how that liability will be played out in the courts to that bill being passed.
So essentially what we're saying here is that for an electro-sensitive individual living in a municipality that is putting in citywide Wi-Fi, the only advice we have for them is get out, get out, get out.
Well, Janet might want to speak this a little bit more, but I believe this is not my area of expertise in terms of, products that may be on the market.
Windows and things like
that. There are ways of, mitigating it for people who are experiencing, symptoms right now. There are actual ways to go about protecting yourself, literally.
Well, give us a couple of examples, because right now it's you and Jan, so.
Right. Well, some of this deals with what we're not talking about right now, which is Wi-Fi. There are what they call dirty electricity, where different harmonics or frequencies of the electricity that runs through someone's house. There are filters that can be put in that for people who experience symptoms in situations living in a house where this type of electricity is prevalent. Types of ways to mitigate. People who have expertise in that area, I'm not one of them, and I don't want to start advising products that I'm not familiar with. But Janet may have better grasp of that. But I think both she and I are folks who are really part of what we focus on is the political side of this and trying to move policy and also education. I mean, that's one thing that you brought up, and then one thing why this radio program is so important. Because even in San Francisco, where we have a fairly well-informed and even organized group of people over the past 5 years that have been fighting cell phone towers, there's often a disconnect. They say, oh, Wi-Fi, well, that's not a problem, right? You even have to educate folks who are relatively well-informed about this issue that, well, no, Wi-Fi is part of the problem as well. It's a slightly different power level, it's a slightly different frequency, but it's still raising the same problem. So it's there's a lot of education that has to be done. And one reason why I think people have been falling in love with these technologies is that this has been happening without that information being provided to them, and that hasn't been part of their decision making process to embrace these new and rapidly emerging technologies.
I've done several shows with Cindy Sage, who has a website which is sageassociates.com, I believe. .net. Sageassociates.net. SAGassociates.net. And they are people who actually go out and measure milligauss and electromagnetic things. And they also, she's, more the technical side. She was, so there are several shows on my back on the website in the show list that you can look at with Cindy Sage. But I remember a few things that we talked about, and one of them is that Wi-Fi causes insensitive individuals insomnia. And I knew that, and I went to Santa Cruz and spent, which has now really got Wi-Fi everywhere, and I spent the night in a very crunchy granola bed and breakfast that I really like. And they... everything's very, no fragrances, everything's very clean. And I went to bed, and I literally could not sleep a minute the entire night. I've never had that experience before. My eyes were like two hard-boiled eggs. I mean, I could not. And in the morning, I went down, and I said, did you put Wi-Fi in? And she said, oh, yes, we just did. And I told her what happened, and they're looking into it. But these are people who are very health conscious and very, So that was one experience. And then Cindy has talked endlessly about this phenomena that we all see with people with cell phones, which is that there are brain changes that are similar to the brain changes we see in addiction. People on cell phones, you will notice, will be with other people, and they're not conversing with the other people. They're talking on the cell phone. And then they get off the cell phone, they immediately dial another number. And they it's like people can't be alone for 2 seconds. And in your film, there are some people talking about this. You interview some people. And I remember this one woman who said, I had to get used to not using it. But once I stopped using it, it was like, what am I doing? Why am I on the phone all the time? So there really is something going on here that's quite sinister, I believe. Do you want to comment at all, either of you?
Well, I think there is a whole social, issue as well, which we haven't yet gotten into, and which is also, you can talk about pollution can take many forms, and social pollution or increasing privatization of public space and so forth, where people are engaged in their own private conversations on buses in San Francisco all the time, and not really interacting with the people who are around them.
But they are exposing them to radiation.
That's true as well. I think that there's a lot of dimensions to this that again, people plunge in, think this stuff is wonderful, and without thinking through the results too clearly.
Yeah. Just briefly, you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. We're talking about Wi-Fi public health crisis. I'm speaking with Doug Loringer, independent filmmaker. His film is called Bad Reception, The Wireless Revolution in San Francisco. And we have Jan Newton on the line as well. Her website is eluding me at this moment.
www.emrpolicy.org.
Right, emrpolicy.org. Jan,
To follow up on your yes, anecdote
please.
About Wi-Fi and sleeping, and I live in rural Vermont, and it's starting to be the next thing that wants to be rolled out here is broadband internet access wirelessly. But there are people have it in their homes as well. And it's interesting the people who will tell you about it. And I try not to ask them. I try to just keep them going in the conversation long enough and see if they mention anything. And what they will mention is noticing that they don't sleep as well. You know, I don't want to ask that question and kind of suggest the answer, but I've had that same comment.
You can use internet access and use a wired router. And I keep telling people this. They call me, go, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And I'm going, use a wired router. We live rurally as well, and we have the wire up the deer fence. It goes almost half a block up to Jeffrey's office. I mean, it's not difficult to use wired technology. You can use phones. In fact, if you're worried about your exposure ambiently because you live in a city, you could certainly start reducing your other exposures by moving the little AC adapter boxes, little transmitter boxes that you have that plug in your equipment further away from your body by using only corded phones in the house. You can even buy headset-compatible corded phones. You can eliminate your own radiation effect. Although in Doug's film, there's a fellow in the city who had somebody come with a meter, and he measured what was going on in terms of radio frequency radiation in this guy's house, and it was the same as somebody being on a cell phone all the time. And this guy doesn't even have any of these technologies. So there's a lot of pollution. Let's leave people with some ideas of what they can do in their communities in terms of activism.
Well, I was made aware today of an article that was in the January 28th issue of Science News. Senator Durbin from Illinois added a provision to the funding bill for Health and Human Services that requires any of the money appropriated in for those departments that science that is dispensed by those departments has to be accurate and cannot disseminate scientific information that's deliberately false or misleading. So I'm thinking there may be an action to take here, have people contact their congressional offices and ask for the same provision for departments such as EPA, FDA that regulate cell phones, and the FCC, because they're the ones that have responsibility for radio frequency radiation in the environment as well. So,
are you going to have some kind of link on your website?
Yeah. And it comes from the Union of Concerned Scientists. That's the organization that's been working on this effort so far. So they have an office in Washington, D.C. That's the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Well, but where can they find the link on your website? Will it be on the homepage?
It would be on the news page. I'll get something up. I just got this.
Please.
Today,
okay. So emrpolicyinstitute.org.
Without the institute, just EMR.
Oh, I keep doing that. I'm so sorry. emrpolicy.org. emrpolicy.org. And it's on our website. Doug.
Well, I say if you're like we are in San Francisco and facing Wi-Fi, possible that your local government going into the Wi-Fi business or blanketing your city, then you know, the first thing is you talk to your neighbors, you express your concerns, you refer them to the kind of information that's being discussed on today's program, and then you get organized and you approach your elected officials and you tell them, you know, enough is enough. We don't want Wi-Fi to provide broadband. There are alternatives. There are ways you can deliver it with fiber optic cable and other ways. You can get, perhaps if there's a local cable company with a monopoly, you can get a franchise agreement where they're providing low-cost or free broadband to low-income people. The main thing is talk to your neighbors, preferably not over a cell phone, and then organize and get out and let your elected officials know how you feel and have them hopefully act in a way that's going to be consistent with the kind of health concerns that we've raised today.
Or at least also ask that if something is about to be erected, like a new tower or a new antenna or something near you, have that there's some kind of assessment done. And we've given several resources. Blake Levitt's website is one, blakelevitt.com, L-E-V-I-T-T, or Sage and Associates, which is sageassociates.net, N-E-T. Well, we're going to have to let you go because we're really out of time, but I wish us all a lot of luck on this. It's a relief to know that there really are alternative technologies, and it may be my next place to go is to look into that, so I may be able to do some kind of lucid report on that. So maybe that's where I'll go next with it. But I really want to thank you both for your time. Jan Newton from the EMR Policy Institute, EMR.org. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for covering the topic again.
Yes. And Doug Loringer, independent filmmaker, Bad Reception, The Wireless Revolution in San Francisco, thanks so much for your time and your work.
Thank you.
Okay. And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or if you want a CD copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours at 707-874-2772 for a list of other available shows, information about guests, and news about the nonprofit and the benefits of membership. Go to the website, yourownhealthandfitness.org. That's Your Own Health and Fitness with Anne spelled out. And you can hear the show all week long, 24/7. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness and KPFA-FM. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.